Chapter 8, Ellie. I'm just going to tell you right now, I really like this chapter. February 7th, 2019, Davis and San Francisco, California. Ellie strapped Nathan tightly into his car seat, feeling the heavy mist of the bay's morning marine layer dripping on her back and hair. When she had both boys buckled in and the engine started, she caught a glimpse of herself in the rearview mirror. The minimal makeup she'd quickly applied had already melted away, and her hair. So much for the swishy, shiny look. It was just going to be one of those bad hair days. As she drove through the morning traffic approaching the Presidio, Ellie glanced at Nathan's little face peering out the window and felt her heart ache at his quietness. He'd been withdrawn ever since they'd come back from Chicago. It was as though he'd got a taste of what it was like to spend all day with her, and he was resisting reverting to daycare. He wasn't getting as much of her attention as he deserved, she knew. It was Luca, with all his extra needs, that took up most of her spare time, for in the evenings she worked with him on word recognition and picture cards and charted his notes and progression in the reports the Mind Institute had asked her to fill out. As Nathan was doing just fine, he was often left to amuse himself. No matter how thinly she spread herself, it seemed impossible to balance everyone's needs, and she woke up each new day prepared to fail all over again. A pileup on Highway 80 East to Davis deposited Ellie and Luca 10 minutes late for their appointment. Luca could always sense her stress levels when they were high and could act out, so she took deep breaths and she rushed into reception, apologizing. She seemed to be doing a lot of that lately, rushing and apologizing. 5 minutes later, with Luca handed off for his appointment, she was seated at the cafe, mascara still smudged, hair frizzing and unruly, her vintage jacket giving off an odor as it dried. Dry clean only, thank you, San Francisco fog, with Teddy's diary in her hand. Finally, her adrenaline began to slow. Finally, she could relax into this moment over her hot chai latte, a treat she permitted herself on these Davis trips. Today, she had also indulged in a pain au chocolat, and as she bit into it and watched the flakes flutter all over the diary, she went to blow them away, just as a man in teal-green scrubs approached and asked, "Is the seat taken?" The doctor's timing was mortifying, if not comical. Ellie blew the flakes right into his space, across his hands, some landing and sticking into his groin area. "Oh my God," shot Ellie. "I'm so sorry." He laughed. Ellie looked up to see a doctor she recognized but had never spoken to. He was tall and robust, carrying himself effortlessly, his posture graceful and poised. "Don't worry," he smiled again. Ellie stood quickly, took her napkin, and began flapping it towards his scrubs to dust off her pastry shower. When she realized what she was doing, for she was very close to the stranger's pelvic area, she sat back down again abruptly and shook her head in disbelief at her actions. The doctor looked a little bemused at her strange napkin dance. "I am really sorry," she said, and she felt a blush rise in her face. I don't know. The doctor sat down in the chair and put his tray with pressed green apple juice and oatmeal on the table. "You're fine," he said. "Honestly, as long as you don't mind that I sit here." Ellie looked around. The cafe had completely filled up with staff on breaks, joining other parents and guardians who had taken their charges to the institute that day. Normally, she preferred her own space for these precious, quiet moments to herself, but sometimes it happened that the tables at the small cafe had to be shared. She glanced at the doctor and nodded before turning back to Teddy's diary. He looked like Hansa, and she presumed he was of Indian origin. His speech was accented, too. Finding it hard to concentrate on the writing in front of her, she glanced up again to notice the doctor studying the diary. "Is that yours?" he prompted gently. "The diary." "Not mine," said Ellie, "unless you think I look like I was born in 1854. The doctor broke into a grin. "It's a well-guarded medical secret that a steady diet of flaky pastries reverses the aging process, so you could be very well preserved." Ellie giggled. Actually giggled. In her troll-like state, it must have made her look like the Mad Hatter's first cousin. "I'll be sure to increase my dosage starting tomorrow, and don't worry, your secret is safe with me." The doctor nodded with a satisfied smile. "But wow, is it that old?" he asked. "Yep," smiled Ellie. It's my great-great-grandmother's. I found it recently and have been reading it whenever I get a chance, which is not often. Where was she from? Asked the doctor. Born near Boston, and so far she's been to Chicago, but I don't know where she goes next. Actually, I don't know anything about her, really. So, an adventure story, said the doctor. Kinda. She has to have somehow met my great-great-grandfather, right? And I'm pretty sure he lived most of his life in San Francisco. Well, our family house near Chennai is 200 years old, and all the grandfathers have their paintings on the wall. Chennai, so he was from the southeast of India. Hansa from Kerala had come from the most southern end of the country. But none of the women, mused Ellie, on the walls? No, he responded. You're right. None of the women are on the wall. I don't know much about my great-great-great-grandmother either. I'll bet, said Ellie amicably. She noticed the doctor's name tag, Dr. Samarjit Varma. She tried to go back to her reading, but as she listened to his scrapings on the bowl, she couldn't help but look back up. Will you have long to wait? He asked kindly. It depends, said Ellie. I'm waiting for my son. Today he's having an eye-tracking test, and if that doesn't work out, they might try again later or wait till next week. I understand how these things can go. I work in neurology. So, you visit regularly? Yep, said Ellie. Usually Thursday, though depends on the clinic and my schedule and what they need to get done. Dr. Varma had the kindest eyes, Ellie noticed, dark, thoughtful, and deep. My, he was handsome. It was rude to stare, but she didn't want to look away. Why, of all days, had she met this lovely-looking doctor when she was looking the worst she had looked, possibly ever? The doctor drained his juice, leaving just frothy remnants. Break over. Well, I hope the adventure continues, he said, pointing to the diary. I'm Samarjit Varma. People call me Sam. Ellie Benvenuto. She didn't reach out her hand for Sam to shake, but she wanted to. Nice to meet you, Ellie, he said. See you around, I'm sure. Bye, Ellie smiled, consciously smoothing down her rebel hair. Phew, she thought as Sam walked away. She noticed he moved as though he'd been trained, like a dancer or gymnast or in some other exacting athletic discipline. Pressure off, time to try and relax again. Back to Teddy's diary, only, oh, there was her phone. Miss Benvenuto, said the voice of the receptionist at Luca's clinic, a voice that Ellie had become very familiar with, for she always called when it was time to collect Luca. Luca's ready for you now. The test didn't go as planned, unfortunately, so we're going to try again this afternoon. His next appointment will be in 45 minutes. If you could just come pick him up now? Ellie sighed and slid Teddy's diary back in her bag. There went the break. Still, she thought, as she walked out of the camera area. Sorry, still, she thought, as she walked out of the cafe area. Meeting Sam had felt unexpectedly inspiring. The Workers' Rights Clinic that evening was held at UC Hastings College of Law at San Francisco's Civic Center, an easier journey for Ellie than out to Berkeley, but still, the class falling on the same day as Luca's Mind Institute appointment was a marathon. The Workers' Rights Clinic operated at both the Berkeley and San Francisco Law School campuses to accommodate the guest lecturers and meet the needs of the client population that came to the clinics. Tonight's lecturer was the one and only Ruby Martinez, who was not only the founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the Law School, but in Ellie's considered opinion, a living legend. Just home from one of her stints testifying before Congress, Ellie wouldn't have been surprised to witness Ruby's arrival via helicopter landing on the roof. Regularly sought out by the media and juggling a zillion speaking invitations, Ruby was a wiry, indefatigable, no-nonsense legal scholar and activist. Ellie was excited to meet her that night and saw it as a mark of her character that she would make time to mentor students when she had so many demands on her schedule. Ellie, as the day played out, had no time to go home to change or fix her hair. She just about managed to drop the boys off with Joe before landing at the law school's main building 5 minutes ahead of Ruby's arrival. Aware that she was, again, not putting her best foot forward, Ellie grumbled to herself as she scanned the lecture room. But when she turned and spied Ruby, she realized she need not have worried. Ruby's auburn hair was closely cropped, and she was dressed in khakis and trainers, devoid of jewelry or other frivolities. She looked ready to march on Washington at a moment's notice, with spare bottles of water and trail mix staged in her knapsack, rather than tutor a class of law students. Ellie immediately felt at ease and warmly shook Ruby's hand, who smiled back. Some departure from Professor Hayes, huh? There was no time to chat, as Ellie was immediately called away by a student needing assistance accessing the room. When Ruby called the class to order 5 minutes later, a particular hush descended that Ellie sensed portrayed the understanding of the talent that stood before them. Ruby began to speak, addressing the students with the intensity of a low, rolling thunder. Let's get started, everyone. By now, you understand the basics of a workplace discrimination cause of action. Prima facie case, protected category, adverse action. Now, it's time to get more nuanced. Not everything fits neatly into a category, and a skilled attorney learns to spot a legally actionable situation that the client may not recognize, or how biases can be adjacent to a protected category, even if not explicitly provided for in established law. This is a constantly evolving, fast-paced area of legal specialty, and if you choose it, expect no self-driving cars. You can't fall asleep at the wheel. The students chuckled. Ruby used the remote clicker to bring up her first slide. One example of adjacent bias is caregiver discrimination. It's something that we are actively working on at the Center for Work-Life Law. Although caregiver status is not a protected category, women disproportionately perform caregiving work, and thus it acts as a de facto form of gender-based discrimination in the workplace. Ellie sat up straighter to listen as Ruby, just limbering up, pressed on. Caregiving work is what makes all other work possible. Think about it. Ruby waited, arms crossed, with her direct gaze moving from student to student, letting them ponder her words. After a protracted pause, she advanced to the next slide, depicting a graph, and began to rattle off facts and statistics. Failing to shore up the child care industry means holding back nearly every sector of the economy. 75% of care work worldwide is performed by women and girls, is unpaid or low wage, and is heavily weighted to groups that are traditionally marginalized. It has a profound impact on gender inequality and deepens poverty. In all regions of the world, mothers experience a wage penalty of about 7% per each child. In the U.S., it's only about 4%. Childbearing is seen as an instability and indicator that women are less committed to their careers. All the while, they are held to higher performance standards than non-mothers. Top income earners have less a penalty than low income earners, so those who can least afford it pay the most penalty. Ellie sat, glued to her chair, Ruby's words ping-ponging at speed around her mind. Penalty per each child. Higher performance standards. Less committed to their careers. That was exactly how she'd been made to feel at Hutton and Fetterer. Ruby momentarily relented her rapid-fire oration and looked out again among the students to add, "This gap by women is never regained over time. In fact, at the current rate, it will take more than 250 years to close the gender pay gap." Ruby advanced to the next slide and continued at a heightened volume and pace. Inversely, there's a bonus for fatherhood. It's seen as a strength, stability, and admirable commitment to work. Fathers see an increase with each child of about 6%. Do the math. That's a gap of 10% in wages between mothers and fathers for the first child, which widens for each child born. Ellie felt herself tense, almost wincing. She thought of the hand-shaking and back-slaps the men had given each other at work when they'd returned a day or two after their wives had given birth, how they'd gone for drinks at lunch to wet the baby's head, how the jokes had all been about diapers and late nights and the end of a sex life, and that in the week that followed, she'd notice how those same men had often stayed longer in the evenings, and she'd realize they were actively avoiding going home. No wonder they got bonuses and climbed the career ladder when staying late was no issue. Ellie surveyed the room. The students were enraptured. No hands were raised with questions, just the clickety-clack of fingers flying on keyboards as most feverishly typed notes in an effort to keep up with Ruby. The kicker is that these lower wages don't favor the bottom line of companies either. Workplaces in the U.S. are losing $35 billion per year $35 billion per year by not tracking caregiver status of their employees, but organizations and the economy cannot afford to lose women. Why? Mothers are drivers of the economy and the primary shoppers in their households. 70% of U.S. mothers are working and contribute an average of 40% to household income. And the poorest families, that number increases to 86%. A brave student's hand shot into the air to interrupt Ruby's flow. But this isn't new, is it, Professor Martinez? It's the glass ceiling dilemma, right? The young woman who asked had short bobbed hair and looked as earnest and as fresh as they came. Ellie sensed the determination from her. Ruby didn't blink. We associate the so-called glass ceiling cases with women barred from top rungs of elite professions, but here we're talking about every occupation from surgeons to law enforcement to grocery clerks. To be clear, caregiving work isn't just about child care. It's about care for the elderly and disabled as well, all which disproportionately falls upon women who end up either forfeiting a paid livelihood, voluntarily or otherwise, or maneuvering caregiving work with a real job, unable to meet expectations. Ellie felt as though her breathing was catching in her throat. Her mind was racing and her heart pumping. An eerie silence hung over the room as if the atmosphere had been sucked out of it and they all sat motionless in a vacuum. As you gather information and listen to clients' stories, listen carefully. Listen to them like they've never been listened to before. Listen for clues that, although might not conveniently conform to a category, may still be actionable and imperative to spot if we are to evolve public policy in this area, concluded Ruby. Her talk was met with rapturous applause. Ellie jumped up, oversaw the students out towards the dining hall where clinic clients awaited, and rushed towards Ruby, who had her knapsack already packed. We didn't get a chance to speak earlier, gushed Ellie. I so enjoyed your talk. It was disturbingly illuminating. Ellie Benvenuto, said Ruby warmly. I know who you are. I've heard about the incredible work you're doing. You're such an asset. It's critical that we have attorneys like you who lean into the work and your reputation precedes you. Ellie was taken aback. Ruby Martinez knew who she was and had an opinion of her? Oh, my reputation? She laughed nervously. I had no idea. You know, your talk really hit close to home with me. There were so many things that, Her voice trailed off, and she shifted from one foot to another, as Ruby regarded her thoughtfully. That you could relate to? Prompted Ruby. Ellie nodded, her eyes darting. Ruby tilted her head. What's on your mind, Ellie?
Well, it's just that I was listening, and it got me thinking about how I was...
Why was... Yes? Prompted Ruby kindly.
Well, said Ellie, taking a deep breath. I was actually fired from my previous law firm after I gave birth to my second child, when my first child was diagnosed with disabilities. I was the most senior person in the group, and they wouldn't even have a discussion with me. They just cut me off cold, and while that was quite a shock, there was some other stuff going on as well leading up to that, and... Again, Ellie's voice trailed off. Oh, what a torrent. This was a mistake. She suddenly wished for a San Francisco earthquake that would swallow her into a sinkhole. She was stumbling over her words, couldn't organize her thoughts, and didn't want to take up this renowned and brilliant woman's time.
Let's sit, Ellie. I'd like to hear more. My center is doggedly lobbying right now for caregiver status to be included as a legally protected category in the workplace. We're preparing to present a roster of cases to the EEOC to issue official guidelines as a pathway to legislation, and it's hard to get people to come forward and actually bring lawsuits. Your situation is more important than you may think. But an overwhelming sense of fear and embarrassment washed over Ellie, as if her energy supply had been cut off. She wilted, barely able to summon another word.
I'd like to, said Ellie. I would, but... I have to see the students now. Maybe we could talk again?
Sure, said Ruby, clearly reading that Ellie was just not able to go into everything there and then.
Whenever you need.
She took a business card from her knapsack, jotted down another number on it, and handed it over to Ellie. Just remember that we can help you. Don't let them get away with this. We have connections with attorneys who are ready, willing, and able to take a case like yours.
A case like hers? So she did have a case then?
The thought of it all was too big, though. She was bone-tired, and her evening was not even over, not by a long shot.
Call or text me anytime. That's my personal number there, said Ruby as she walked up the steps from the lecture room towards the exit. Anytime, Ellie. Ellie sighed, pushed her hand through her tousled hair, and thought about the long shower she was going to take when she finally got the kids to bed that night. It was all still some hours away. The caregiving load. Well, if there was one thing she knew about, it was certainly that. And then I'll go ahead and tell you the clipping between chapters 8 and 9 is really just a quote, and it's this. Kill every buffalo you can. Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone. Colonel Richard Dodge, 1867, Black Hills.